Hello, I'm John Ingold.
And I'm Sagar Baroshi.
And welcome to the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope podcast. Each week, we open to a different article in the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope book, and we invite the author of that article onto the podcast to discuss their chosen topic and, in general, their career and their approach to writing for games. So it's really all about the craft of interactive writing and narrative design. And this week, we're really lucky to have with us a hugely experienced writer in the industry, Giles Armstrong. Giles, good evening.
Hey, hi guys. How you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely brilliant to have you here. For the benefit of listeners who don't necessarily recognise your name, could you briefly outline how do you fit into the games industry? What have you worked on? What kind of writer are you? Tell us about yourself.
No, I refuse. That's my contribution.
Excellent. Podcast over. We're done.
Excellent.
Go home, Giles.
Thank you.
We finished.
Finally, a writer who likes brevity.
For once.
Well, look. I mean, we'll get onto it later, but subverting expectations is it's a surefire way to many people's heart. Okay. Who am I? Hi, my name's Giles Armstrong. It's a super posh name. I didn't choose it for myself. I apologize. I'm not that posh guy, but I've been working in the games industry since 2007. So I've been writing for games almost that long, which is coming up to 20 years almost. Right now, at the time of recording, I am the principal writer for Wushu Studios, who are a codev studio based in Liverpool, and they've worked on loads of brilliant big games. Prior to that, I was a freelance game writer for about a decade. I've also been a member of the BAFTA Games Committee. I co-founded Tailspinners with Ian Thomas, who Saga will vouch is just an absolute genius. He's amazing.
And is also a guest on our podcast here, so we'll be both.
Yeah, and it is empirically an absolute genius. Yeah, that's definitely true.
He's phenomenal. Getting to work with him on projects was just, dream come true. I've been a Limit Break mentor. I've written on loads and loads and loads of indie games that no one's ever heard of, and a few bigger titles that people have, including three Assassin's Creed projects, Horizon Forbidden West, Guardians of the Galaxy, incredibly briefly, I must add. I was the narrative director for Sniper Elite Resistance, and I'm currently on Helldivers 2, which, Saga, I think you know quite well.
We know a little well over here, yeah.
And I'm a senior writer on that at the moment.
It's just such an extraordinarily detailed career. One thing I really love about talking to the freelancers in the industry, if that's a fair description of you, the freelancers, is that after a while they are so very freelance that they've kind of seen every scale of project and every size of team and every crisis and every solution. And I just think that's really brilliant. But that's not how we're going to start the podcast. We're going to start the podcast with our standard branded question, because we like to have a tiny pretense at structure, even if we don't believe in the hero's journey. So, Saga, will you please take over for us?
Speaking of that structure, Giles, you've contributed an article here to GNK. That article is titled The Grenade Paradox, Writing Better Barks. And I wonder if you could summarize it for us, please.
Yeah, absolutely. Writing barks in games is considered to be one of the kind of bread and butter tasks, the kind of thing that you do from the second that you enter the industry. And it's that well-worn cliche that you're having to say the same thing hundreds and thousands of times. And writing grenade, just that word, grenade, there's apparently only a finite number of ways that you can do that. And I think that that's bobbins. I think that there are so many ways of adding nuance and depth to something as simple as that. But in the article, my argument is that the more common an action is in the game, the more generic the line should be, because barks are one of the primary ways that players interface with a game. It's the thing that is surrounding them and their experience almost all the time. And when you apply for a writing job, it's also one of the most fundamental parts of most writing tests. To the point
that's
where
very true. Yeah.
To the point where I, if you look me up on YouTube, you'll find I did a webinar about writing samples, and Barks is a key part of that. But yeah, it's for me, I love writing Barks because it's a bit of a puzzle in that there is a particular function that they must fulfill. And I put forward that there are three functions for a Bark. And the Bark must always inform the player. And if possible, delight the player. Because if a player hears a line that puts a smile on their face, it's going to stick with them. They're going to want to say it again. They're going to quote it, maybe. So that's the main thing, is Barks are not just dialogue. Like, they're systems. They serve a function, a very specific function. And yeah, I put forward a few tips and a few ideas on how to make them better.
So make them work. Yeah.
I really liked the article because it was nice and crunchy and technical and detailed. It was just really getting down into, you could absolutely feel the fact that you've done this 100 times and you actually, there's no theory here. Or there is theory, but there's a huge amount of practice and just craft essentially behind it. And I think one of the other things I really like about it was the way that you're describing the construction of a bark. I don't want to get too side-railed too early on, but it sounds to me, in a way, you're actually describing just writing in general. Like, all writing has to serve a function, and all writing has to delight the player, and all of these things. Like, there's nothing, in a sense, barks are just, they're just short or procedural or something else, but it's still just kind of part of that business of putting words together. But I thought the one question that I had when I was reading it was about sort of the kind of the edges of the problem of writing barks, because it feels to me like the really big problem with barks is pacing, right? It's that problem of repetition, or things being, hearing the same line over and over again close together, but we don't know how long the player is going to be in a play environment, really, ever at all. And that it's almost like that's a separate part from the writing, because it's just a different problem to solve, but of course it impacts what you do right down to the root level, right? You can't do a speech about grenades every time, because it's going to get done 3 times in a row. So my first question was, when you're writing this sort of stuff, do you think about pacing as you're writing it? Is that a problem that you kind of ship off to the designers? Is it a second stage problem? Does it help to think about it when you're trying to compose the barks in the first place? Or do you want to just sort of say, I'm going to think about the delivery systems later, because it will get in the way of the actual business of writing? Like, how useful is that, and how much of it is it a problem for other people? And
honestly, it's one of those things that where it depends on how involved in the project I am, because when I've been a freelancer, sometimes it's just a case of I get parachuted in at the end, they give me a brief, I deliver a script, they say thank you, here's your check, bye-bye. Right. Sometimes I'm a lot more involved, and yeah, I'll be thinking about the delivery systems, and if I can, playing the build and playing the build with like placeholder lines in there. Sometimes I'll record the scratch audio myself if need be. I'm always thinking about the pacing, and also as politely as possible saying to programmers and designers, here are the trigger points, here are when lines should happen, when they shouldn't happen, here's the percentages of the chance of a line triggering. Mm-hmm. And also things like burn rates. You know, if you've heard this one line once, then it should be out of the pool that can be selected for the next, I don't know, 5 or 6 selections, with like a decreasing chance of probability of a bark even triggering. Which is to say, I do think about it, but at the writing stage, it's just about, does the bark do what it needs to? Is it entertaining? And if it's something that's going to happen super frequently, is it going to bump the player? Is it going to stand out? And I mean, one of the things with Sniper Elite Resistance, mm-hmm. they actually adjusted the frequency that some of the barks triggered. A couple of months down the line, so the initial reviews were picking up on Harry Hawker, the lead character, frequently walking into tall grass and going, tall grass, itchy, but effective, or, you know.
And that's what I say every time I walk into tall grass.
Exactly. That's, you know, it's realistic.
I say, where are my feet? My feet have gone.
And that was one of the lines that we inherited from the previous game in the series, because Harry Hawker is a character who recurs a few times, and this is his game where he's the first one in the starring role. And unfortunately, that line triggers incredibly frequently in the vanilla version of the game. It's a bit better now, but still, to my taste, it's, you know, I like it to trigger a bit less frequently. But yeah, no, it's definitely a consideration. And it's one of the reasons why, again, I advise the more, the less frequent something occurs, the more bespoke, the more special that you can make a line.
Well, I mean, I have to say, I love that you chose this topic for your article. If only because you and I have been friends for many years and we have had real life conversations just about barks, right? So I know this has interested you for a really long time. And you make this strong point in the article that's related to what you said just there. And I wonder if you can help us expand on this a bit, especially for writers who are a little bit less used to the variety of ways in which you might engage with a project as a freelancer in-house. And that strong point is, working in parallel with a scripter is almost essential for, let's say, the ideal way that barks could flow. I wonder whether you could sort of walk us through what you think is maybe the ideal way of doing it, or a way in which it's worked really well for you. Is it just you fill in a spreadsheet, you sort of pass it off to someone? Is it better if you're in person with them? I know you're not writing about barks, you know, all year long or something, right? But in the period in which you're working on them, what's the best way of getting the best result out of barks?
So for this, I've got to go back to one of my favorite examples. So the first Assassin's Creed project that I worked on was let's get the full title, because otherwise I'll get told off. Assassin's Creed Valhalla, Dawn of Ragnarok. So it was an expansion to Assassin's Creed Valhalla, because that game is so tiny, it needs to be expanded three times, right?
It was just feeling a bit insecure.
There's so much to say about the UK. We of course need to have the biggest and most expensive of the Assassin's Creed games.
And I'm honestly, it's to date, it's still one of my favorite professional experiences ever.
Really?
Working on that. Yeah. Because the expansion, for anyone who doesn't know about Assassin's Creed Valhalla, most of it takes place, you play as a Viking, but there are some sequences that take place in a more fantastical realm of Asgard or other Norse realms. Spoilers for a game that came out quite a long time ago. And the expansion takes place fully in this Norse mythology setting, time period. And it's great because you're basically, spoilers for Assassin's Creed Valhalla, Dawn of Ragnarok, playing as...
This whole podcast is spoilers, Giles, I should say. So yeah, you're
you're basically playing as Odin, who in the game is called Havi. And one of the things that I really enjoy is taking a character who is full of self-importance and placing them into a situation where no one gives a toss who they are, so that they get flustered, so they get annoyed, and putting them into a situation where they've got like multiple levels of conflict with the world, with the people around them and things like that. And working on this game, we would frequently have playthroughs with the level designers, with their bosses, sometimes with like the creative director and the game directors, but we'd be playing through frequently, and the systems that we'd use, the placeholder lines would be populated with like robotic, you know, text to speech. But as we'd play through, we would test it again and again and again to see where the lines are triggering, and I would. This is going to sound really, really pretentious, but I would do what I would call like method writing. So I would play the build and just think and feel like I am the character, and just look around and what are the details that I'm noticing? What are the, you know, the textures, the sounds, the animations? But also on these playthroughs, the thing that would really bring it all to life are the little kind of jokes that people would make. And there was one level designer in particular, Stefan, who's brilliant. And he would just always just be like wisecracking as he's playing, but in character. And it was the thing that I loved to do is anytime he said an absolute zinger, I would jot it down. And the next time he played the build, he would hear his line triggered at the place where he said it. And as soon as he saw that and enjoyed that, it also invited everybody else on the playthroughs to start wisecracking as we were playing. And some of the lines, you know, wouldn't work because not everyone is a comedic genius or, you know, inappropriate or whatever. But every now and then, the team would contribute these just brilliant little insightful lines or just moments of wit, and they would get to feel that ownership over that line and overseeing it in the game, and eventually hearing phenomenal professional actors bring these lines to life. And so for me, that's the thing. So like these are lines with sort of specific triggers, you know, going past a particular volume within the level or things like that, whereas the more kind of systemic barks, again, it'd be a case of playing it and seeing how often something's triggering, if it still works. But that was like my absolute favorite.
That's amazing that you got that level of kind of collaborative iteration in such a large studio game.
Yeah, we never like, get this. That's so rare.
Like in an indie studio, that kind of tight loop of people sort of having good ideas and then shoving them in the build kind of enthusiastically, that's one of the great strengths of kind of being a small studio. But I didn't even think that happened in large studios at all. It's so good to hear.
In this instance, it would be like smaller subset of people. Right. So the way that the workload would have been divided, it would be everybody who was working on that particular quest line, that particular set of quests. And so we'd always be playing it and replaying it for the flow of it, for really just to make sure that it was fun and cohesive, and, you know, also to spot anything that kind of, again, bumps us and needs to be fixed or anything. But yeah, no, it's brilliant.
That means you must have had quite a good level of trust from the people above, though, that they kind of gave you enough ownership of those levels to do that work. Like, they weren't trying to micromanage it. They weren't sort of too involved with it. There wasn't anyone saying, this is the script and you've got to stick to it, but giving you that kind of trust to really just layer it and layer it and layer it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's an earned trust from, you know, I've got a decent CV, but but it's all, but also it's through the conversations that led to getting the job as well, kind of discussing the project and being able to show an understanding of the IP, of the moments, of the tone, in this case, of the Norse mythology parts. But also being able to channel other resources and, just conveying it. And again, you would have those people who would be on the playthroughs once everyone on the team was kind of ready for them, or once they were in the calendar, whichever came first. And they would play through. And you could see, like, everybody on the call would just be kind of just watching this one window on the video call just to see... Oh yeah, he's laughing. Oh yeah, okay. Oh yeah, oh yeah. Oh, wait for it. Oh, she loves it. Yes. You know.
Giles, so nice. I'm a little curious actually, because it sounds like that type. Man, I love the method, right? But that type of method strikes me as really valuable for environmental responses, as you yourself referenced, right? And I wonder, like, but the way you've described it, it does make me wonder. Can we apply a similar process also to the more repetitive barks? Could there simply be this thing where, I mean, I just feel like usually there's a big spreadsheet. I fill it out, and because I know you, I always have in my head, fill out three times as many as what you want, and then cherry pick the best that you want. This is also in your article. Very good advice. It's very easy, like, you know, to keep going. But even so, maybe even those ought to be filled in kind of by like live, like almost pretending to be a streamer on your own title. It is common for us to have a build to work with in this type of scenario, because, you know, barks can often be done a little bit later. There's less pressure on exactly who's recording it. In fact, it's perhaps even better that way because you don't kind of waste time. What do you think? What do you think about that actual process? Like, can you use that kind of more environmental narrative cue based line creation also in a more repetitive scenario?
I think so. I mean, it depends on the project, of course, because if it's something like Helldivers 2, you can reliably see what the different variables are. In the article, I refer to them as stimulus or stimuli, but the variables, the states that are informing when a line might trigger, the more specific you can get with those, the more you can call out their specificity. But again, if it's a project that's far more serious in tone, you know, you can still, on your first draft, you can still write it in a glib way to make it entertaining for you and to keep that kind of interest. But, you know, if it's something like, if you were writing something that felt like The Last of Us, you know, you wouldn't want these wisecracks necessarily.
The ratio might shift, right? Like, actually, because you might actually have more of the, yeah, of the sort of careful storied response at the right trigger at the right moment when the environment is done. And of course, you would still have the sort of more combat-y stuff, but maybe it's even a tiny bit less than you would in
Whereas for me, my go-to projects have got heart and humor. That's the kind of thing that really resonates with me and that I can just inject with a sense of fun. And it's one of the reasons why I'm so glad I lucked out onto getting onto Helldivers 2, to be honest.
I'm very glad you've introduced this topic because, of course, this game is near and dear to my heart. Would you mind sharing a little bit more about what your writing experience has been like on it? Given that, you know, you joined after I left, so apart from us just chatting, I'm not actually sure these days what you're focusing on or how you go about doing it.
Yeah, sure. So I've been on the project for a little more than a year at this point. My introduction to the project, Wushu, my employers were hired to create some of the worlds and the environments and the cities that players will go through. And there's lots of in-game, in-world adverts. And the artists said, "Hey, Giles, do you think you could give us a few ideas for some of the strap lines or what the adverts could be about or things like that?" And I started researching Helldivers 2 at that point. Like, I was aware of it, but I'd never really engaged with it. And at that point, I realized, oh, this is really good. This is really funny and really sharp. And whoever's writing this is just a genius. Like, because I don't consider myself to be a particularly clever person. I'm much more a writer that kind of shoots from the hip. It's emotive, it's humor. You know what I mean? Like, as I said, heart and humor. And so to see something with this kind of level of intelligence and the satire, it was brilliant. So I basically pitched loads and loads of ideas, and the main writer on the project, Stephen Flowers, absolute brilliant guy.
Oh, he's fabulous. Yeah.
Very, very politely and graciously said, "Yeah, these are all wrong." and he talked me through how, like, the adverts that I pitched, it was all kind of player facing. It was all adverts that the Helldivers would respond to, and of course these are the adverts in the cities, and so it's what the citizens, what's being advertised to them. And so instead, we started kind of, I started pitching, oh, okay, so the penthouse apartments that are being advertised, they go above shops, right? Because these levels that are being generated are kind of multi-purpose city blocks. So they're kind of like human shields, aren't they? And we kind of started figuring out the satire on it. And so now there's adverts for, I can't remember what we called it in the end, but initially I think it was called like Frontline Real Estate or something.
That's very good.
And there's, yeah, so like working on the adverts, but where I kind of got fully brought onto the project was to help write thousands, and I do mean thousands, of barks. So when the game introduced the Seif soldiers, which is the...
Actually, I'll tell you what, Giles, let me freeze you for one sec, because just in case our listeners aren't super aware, the reason Helldivers 2 is such a dream project for a writer and narrative designer is because it is it's a satire of Western, particularly Anglo 21st century foreign adventurism, right? And with that, the design of the game has you repeating encounters along all of these different types of worlds where it's set up in a modular and procedural way such that the team can over time keep adding different depth, including the depth like you're talking about. There were no apartment blocks in the version of Helldivers 2 that I helped release. That was something that we added over time to sort of give you the sense that all these foreign colonies that were all being sort of thrown away, where people were being thrown into the meat grinder in a very kind of Verhoeven Starship Troopers way, were also part of this universe. So it's very easy to keep expanding in this way, with the sense of repeat death and all of your very player character being regenerated constantly. So yes, so that's kind of the context of all of this stuff. So please, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and of course, when players first got to visit these cities, which I think was part of the Battle for Super Earth event last year, players got to fight alongside Seif forces, and Seif is Super Earth Armed Forces, and civilians. And so the Helldivers are kind of thought of as the absolute elite, the best of the best, like almost superheroes to the population of Super Earth. But when you play the game, it feels like it's exciting, it's visceral, but it also feels like slapstick and a bit kind of, I'm going to say slapdash, and I don't mean in terms of its construction, but in terms of just how things can just quickly go farcically wrong and be hysterical in the moment.
That's in fact the whole point. That's the whole point, right? That like all of the structure and all of the setup for you being as if you are a 40K super like a space marine, in reality, you are just as squishy as a human today might be. And that's the joke, is that there's sort of these like effectively like local, your next door neighbor who's a soldier who has just been given all of this weaponry that is going to destroy is going to destroy him or her immediately, right? And yeah, that's the satire, right, of course.
Yeah, and basically writing the barks for the more standard soldiers and for the civilians who are all kind of from different walks of life and who all idolize the Helldivers in different ways, but also can kind of embody that, like, I refer to them as space Karens, that kind of indignant, I want to speak to your manager kind of person, you know. And yeah, it was just great. It was like, because again, as you can probably tell, I quite like writing barks. So getting to do that on one of the most successful games in the world, that was pretty cool.
So that's interesting. Like, so if you're writing for the civilian population, am I right in thinking that you're basically writing 1,000 different, whatever number, 1,000 different people? Because like in a kind of Uncharted style firefight where you've got sort of four dudes and the firefight's going to go on for 15 minutes, you're going to hear the same person say more than one thing, right? And so your system has to be pretty generic to handle that, because this character who shouts he's got a big grenade isn't going to suddenly start talking about the flowers. He's got his characterization down, and he also has to be the same as every other guard in the game because that's how the system works, right? But if you have this, it sounds like you had a system where individual people in the world got to say one thing and then were pretty much gone and thrown away, and so each character can be unique and different. Because I can, that tickles me as an idea. I don't know if that's quite how the structure was, but like it, like coming up with 500 ways for the same person to say grenade does sound quite challenging to me. But coming up with 500 different people who all get to remark on grenades differently, and there's the one who says, "Ooh, look at this thing, is it a vegetable?" And then the other one who says, "Oh no!" And the other one who says, "Oh, these are really cheap, these are rubbish, who bought these?" And like, I love that. Is that, am I understanding the kind of the job correctly?
So I'm not going to be glib when I say no. But only because all the lines are voiced, we're constrained in terms of, you know, how much budget in term, like we can spend on different cast, but also I think the game is playable in 14 languages, of which maybe I think 5 or 6 are also recorded in other languages. So it's more like, I guess, 16 or so different voices, which might be, you know, some actors are doing maybe 2 or 3 different voices. And so it's a set number of contexts, and then within each context, I guess it's 20 or 30 lines. And a lot of those lines will be repeated by different actors, but they'll be performing them in different tones. So, you know, someone might be very indignant, very, I want to speak to your manager. Someone might be a lot more like a veteran, you know, oh, I've seen this before, I know what I'm doing, that kind of... or we might have the complete rookie soldier who's, you know, like Eugene from Greece, just, oh my goodness, I don't know what I'm doing. And, you know, but sometimes they might be saying the exact same thing, but it, but the actor is bringing...
Just taking it whichever way they
want
to.
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, part of the conceit of this game is that your player characters are throwaway. And that always struck me as a really good way of making a strength out of a common challenge, which is you're playing a game in which your player character might die, and might die quite regularly. And in most games, certainly most narrative games, you will be resurrected. You will restart the level, and no one's the wiser, right? But in this game, you might spend all of the time like picking your like body build and your voice, right? And then you will die within seconds of landing on the planet, and you will just be regenerated as with the new character. And I always love that. I always just love that. That,
like, and the great thing is, if you're near a civilian or one of the Sieve soldiers, you're either going to get someone who like screams into the heavens, "No, not this helldiver!" Or someone who is like, "Did they just get killed? Are we in danger?" You know, and that's the fun thing is it's thinking about the situation. It's that kind of, again, it sounds pretentious, that sort of method writing, but it's also, it's the world building. It's, okay, what do the people here believe? What do they subscribe to? What are their preferences, their prejudices? Are they performative? Because in the fiction of Helldivers, people are classified. People get like scores for how patriotic they can demonstrate they are. And so even under gunfire, people are still going to want to show, oh, I still believe in the cause. I'm the most patriotic person here.
The alternative is terrible.
Exactly. And so that's the fine line as well, is trying to have the line that fulfills the function, that tells the player, either warns them about something they need to respond to, or confirms that they have just done a thing, or is just flavor. But in the case of Helldivers, it's pretty much always warning the player or confirming that they've done something. And I think one of my favorite ones, I don't know if I've seen the animation, but I remember recording lines where the Sieve soldiers, if they fumbled a grenade. So if you think Guardians of the Galaxy, where Chris Pratt holds up this orb and he kind of drops it and catches it. We had something like that where the soldiers, I think we're going to go to throw a grenade, and just kind of tripped or stumbled or something. And we recorded all those lines. And that's, again, that's such a gift to have just something so human as I am imperfect, and how someone responds to that, how someone covers up for that, or just accepts it, you know.
What's particularly interesting is bringing it back to part of what you said at the beginning. These moments, like that really, that moment, that animated moment, that's a unique moment that people will remember. But some people are going to be playing Helldivers for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours, right? They're going to be playing Helldivers 2 for that long. They will see some of these moments repeated. And even at the very beginning, I remember there were certain barks that were there for liberty, or, you know, like democracy, whatever, all of these things that people recognize, but celebrated when they repeated. They recognized that it was a repeated bark, but they were really into it. I remember seeing all these Reddit posts about like how happy they were every time they sort of saw this happen, or they knew they had really like gotten a real like chain kill of a bunch of enemies or something.
Well, the fiction really supports it as well, because if everybody is saying the same thing and repeating the same thing, you know, they're all drinking from the Kool-Aid. and they want everyone to know about it. Like it's there's something.
Why it worked.
Yeah,
you're right.
Yeah.
That's exactly why it worked. That's why it's so hard to do in many other slightly more realistic or semi-realistic structures. Like that world leans into the absolute absurdity of a Bark-style situation because it's a fascist society that wants you to keep repeating the right lines over and over, or else, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's like contrast it with Assassin's Creed Mirage, you know. And the lines for that generally are far more serious in their tone. It depends on who's saying it and what the situation is. But yeah, by comparison, it feels a lot drier, but it's really about finding the authenticity of the project and of the voice. But it's also, God, I can't stop sounding pretentious, and I think that's the curse of being called Giles. it's finding that like universality in the moment, and that's kind of what I mean about that like method writing thing of trying to play the build, trying to put yourself in the shoes of a character, no matter how small they are, and to see what they see and to hear what they hear, and as well just to think how they would talk to one another, and you know. Are they warning their comrades? Are they warning their best friend? Are they warning someone that they really actually don't want to warn but have to about a particular danger? Yeah.
What I love about this is that you started off saying that Barks are kind of slightly looked down on as a form of writing in the games industry. And yeah, I totally recognize that. And I think the reason for that probably is that if you stop and think about the job of writing Barks, the naive approach is to think, well, firstly, it's very easy because if somebody has got a shotgun, you say, there's a shotgun, and what, you know, that's the job done, right? And then the other problem being obviously that most of the examples that you think of when you just sort of think of it from the top of your head are kind of rubbish because they are just, he's got a shotgun, and this doesn't inspire in confidence in anyone. And if you do that as your writing test, people will say, okay, you haven't really engaged with the material. But listening to you talk about it, you get, because I've never really done Bark writing in any meaningful sense, but listening to you talk about it, I get a sense of how much you've really kind of gone through a process of actually developing a way of thinking about this, of finding seams of Barks and kind of flavors of Barks and structures and lengths and durations and timing that work within whatever project you're working, to the point at which you can start to actually paint with this palette of colors in a meaningful way. And like, yeah, if you listen to someone describe Barks in principle, you say, well, okay, this is just sort of detail, it's like splash effects on the water, it's just surface level stuff. But listening to you talk about it, I get that sense of wait, no, this isn't that at all. This is a really rich source of world building. This is hugely characterful and descriptive. But I get the feeling that you probably wouldn't have got to where you've got, even if the box you produce are actually very short sentences or very simply put, without going through that whole process in the first place. And I just think it's so nice to hear that laid out. Because I often feel as a writer that people sort of think, well, anyone can write. You put words in order and then you've written something. Everyone's got ideas. Everyone tells stories to each other all the time. Everyone's a writer. Everyone's a talker. And I think, well, on the one hand, I think that's kind of true. But on the other hand, I find writing really, really hard. I've had to think about it loads to get even vaguely good at it. So it's really reassuring to me whenever I hear anyone sort of talk about just how much depth it's possible to think about things, even when they look superficially like they might be straightforward. And even if the end result also looks superficially on paper, like 1,000 people saying grenade, you know, that's, it looks simple, but kind of somehow it is actually preternaturally good if you know what you're doing. And I just think that's glorious. There isn't a question in that. I just think it's wonderful.
Well, if it's all right, I wanted to pick up on a couple of things there.
Yeah, go for it.
When you say a lot of people have that sense that everyone can write. I mean, I do frequently, again, in a jokey way, describe myself as a professional selector and arranger of words, because essentially that's what the job is, right? One of the challenges about everyone thinks they can write is because everybody consumes story. Everyone thinks that qualifies them to craft story. But in the same way that I can bake a simple banana bread, but if someone said, hey, could you make a wedding cake for 700 guests that's got to be gluten-free and this and that and the other? I haven't. I don't think I can.
And you've got to do it in a kitchen on a boat.
Yeah. But I mean, the way that I tend to approach writing, honestly, I kind of think of it kind of like a gift for the person who's receiving it. So if you've ever made like a treasure hunt or a scavenger hunt for someone who you care about, you've written clues that you have judged to challenge them exactly right. Like, it's not too hard, or some of them will be a bit harder, some of them will be a bit easier. Maybe it's like a multi-part clue or something, but it's that same level of thought. And that's kind of my approach whenever writing anything for players, is if they're going to spend their money, spend their time in the company of our creations, we've got to make it worth their while. We've got to, like, it's got to be something in it for them. And if it can put a smile on their face, brilliant. If it can shine a light on something that maybe they haven't thought about, or challenge them in ways other than their dexterity, I think there's something just really magic there. Something that we can do with games. And as well, like, one of the best things that any game can do is make a player feel seen, to actually honor their choices, but also to make them feel like they're very much a part of it. You know, there's the thing of show, don't tell. But in games, it's do, then show, then tell. You know, if you can do it in gameplay, brilliant. But yeah, that's the thing, is that not everyone can write in terms of crafting something that's meaningful and fulfills function and fits the budget and this, that, and the other. But everyone can contribute. You know, like, go back to the Dawn of Ragnarok example. So many people had great ideas, and it's just about curating them in that instance. It's about curating them, but also tuning those lines, you know, to make them really land. And when you go through them with an actor as well, you know, it's providing the context, it's describing the scene, and it's also, you know, giving the actors the freedom to have a bit of ownership, to maybe tweak some wording just to flow better or sound better.
I love that idea of writers as being intrinsically generous. Like, there's a kind of generosity of spirit in both, in terms of writing things that the player can feel seen by and engage with, but also the generosity of bringing other people and other voices in and kind of curating and making a space for those voices. I often think back to that there's that line in Adaptation where Nick Cage plays a writer and he goes to meet Robert McKee, and Robert McKee is played by
Brian Cox.
Thank you, Brian Cox. Yes, exactly. And he says that wonderful line, like, people are destroying each other every day, and if you can't see that, then why the hell are you wasting my 2 hours with your movie? This really adversarial, like, idea that you have to attack your audience, you have to brutalize your audience, you have to hurt your audience in order to make your writing worthwhile, that if you're not showing some conflict or destruction or cost, then you're not really doing this job. And I don't know if that's quite what McKee actually says when he talks about writing, but it was a great portrayal. It really stuck with me. But this idea that we should be, that perhaps because games are very good at inviting players in, or perhaps more generally for writing, that we can make spaces that don't have to attack you. We just have to reward you and make you feel seen and as part of the experience, because we're building it for you.
Yeah.
I think that's lovely. I really like that.
For you to rummage around in, right? For you to sort of explore, particularly for worlds and games like the ones that we've mentioned on this episode so far, right? Like, worlds where you're kind of meant to be invited in to explore and to peel back a layer a little bit. It does strike me, like, the insight that I feel I would take away from our discussion here today is it's always worth thinking about the opportunities for character building and world building in the things you are writing, even if it seems to an outsider like the lowliest part of the job, perhaps, because that might actually be like where all the iron ore turns into diamonds. But you can play with foregrounding and backgrounding these things in such a way that supports that goal. So if you are writing a bark and you want that one to be memorable, you have to do it in the right way. You have to make sure you sort of choose your shot, pick the right moment. Ideally, be well aware of the context of the project itself and how it supports or lends what you're doing or not. But you almost always have some sort of choice about what to do there and how to manage it. So, you know, if you have a project that has those types of barks in there, I mean that can be truly a tremendous opportunity to individualize your world, your story, your experience for that player, and to come back to that generosity.
The other thing as well is it's not just the barks, of course. One of the misunderstandings that I'm always having to try to remind people in every project, every studio, is that literally every single part of a game, if it communicates with the player, it can convey narrative. Like even something seemingly as arbitrary as the choice of a font. You know, if the font looks like a punk zine or, you know, printed somewhere versus a Casio LCD kind of font, it says something. Like the semiotics of that creative choice communicates something. And it doesn't communicate story necessarily, but it communicates narrative. It communicates intent. It's always got a message. So even down to the mise-en-scene of a cutscene, even down to color grading, you know, like something that just seems so small and so simple can all contribute to the whole. And that's why, like, no writing is too small, you know? And it's one of the reasons why I love writing barks.
I love that. What a note to close out this episode on, Giles. It's been an absolute delight having you on.
Thank you, Giles.
Yeah, it's been fantastic. Thank you very much. For the rest of the listeners out there, please do join us again next week when we will open our glorious Kaleidoscope book to another page and talk to another brilliantly talented writer. So until then, thank you very much for listening.
And thank you so much for having me.